From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, thousands of people are heading to Washington for tomorrow's presidential inauguration and Saturday's protest march. We'll hear from State Attorney General Maura Healey on the March for Women here in Boston. Also, former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown on why he's going to the inauguration and what he thinks about those protest marches.
If this level of protest was leveled against President Clinton or President Obama, you would just see complete and total 24/7 coverage saying how outrageous it is and how un-American it is, yet you don't hear that.
Also today, we'll take your calls on what you'll be doing this inauguration weekend and your thoughts on the new presidency. Plus,
pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga juju?
Yes.
How the sound of trains got into jazz music. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We begin today with Donald Trump's inauguration as the country's 45th president. And that's happening tomorrow. We'll also look at some of the different perspectives about what's going to be happening. And this Saturday, more than 60,000 people have registered to join the Boston Women's March for America on Boston Common. It's one of about 600 marches planned around the country, all in solidarity with the Women's March on Washington, D.C. Among those scheduled to speak at the Boston March are Senator Elizabeth Warren, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and State Attorney General Maura Healey, who joins us now. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Deborah.
So why speak at the Women's March for America on Boston Common tomorrow?
Well, it's really important to me to be there. It's going to be, I think, a terrific day, a terrific turnout. It's just wonderful to see so many women and men come together at this time and in this moment. You know, there's a lot of fear out there. There's a lot of uncertainty. And I think what I hear and sense and feel across this state is a lot of energy. People are energized, and they want an opportunity to speak out, to act, to get involved, and Saturday is a great way to do just that.
Are there specific goals or objectives here?
I think part of this is about providing an opportunity for people to come together and speak with one voice, that there are certain things that going forward as a state, going forward as a nation, we're committed to. We want access to health care. We want access to reproductive rights. This is a new administration and a president-elect who's made all sorts of statements and promises that are, on one hand, unconstitutional or unlawful or counter to a lot of the gains made and the progress made here in Massachusetts. And a lot of people are really upset about that, and I understand that. I think it's now more important than ever that people come together, that they exercise their right to speak out and to gather and to stand in solidarity and to stand for this purpose of community. And there's a lot of strength in community and strength in unity. And I'm really excited and looking forward to Saturday. And I think what it reflects is how energized and galvanized so many people are as a result of the election and their desire to get involved with their community.
Is this
one of the reasons I've been...
Go ahead.
Yep. Well, I've been doing these town halls around the state, and no matter where I go, I'm seeing crowds and folks come out in numbers that I never could have anticipated. And I think people want to act. They want to get involved, and there are a lot of ways that people can get involved in their communities, in their state, nationally, on matters of policy and on matters of interest. And Saturday's a great opportunity for people to come together. There'll be a great number of people we're expecting in Boston. Right now, it's probably going to be the largest women's march outside of Washington, D.C. And again, I think that just reflects the energy and what we have going on here in Massachusetts.
Would you say it's explicitly an anti-Donald Trump demonstration?
Well, there's no doubt that for many of us, a lot of what Donald Trump stands for, a lot of the policies that he promotes, a lot of his values, as reflected most recently in who he's nominated to serve in really important cabinet positions, are things that are counter to what I believe in and counter to what a lot of folks here in Massachusetts believe in. At least we have a number of concerns. And so on the one hand, I think it is an opportunity to reaffirm a commitment to values and principles and policies that we've fought hard for in Massachusetts, and we don't want to see us go backwards. So it is an opportunity to reaffirm that commitment. It's also, though, an opportunity to come together and be energized and commit, again, as a community, to the work that we're going to need to do here in Massachusetts to make sure that going forward we're protecting people, that we're fighting for and ensuring access to health care, that we're going to have access to reproductive rights, that we're going to take care of immigrant communities, that we're going to stand up for civil rights, and we're going to fight for an economy that really is a democracy. There are people, and far too many people across the state, who are hurting, and we need to make sure that their voices are heard. We also need to make sure that we work hard to fight for good policies when it comes to jobs and the economy and health care and the like. And I think that Saturday is an opportunity for people to come together and express themselves and march in solidarity.
Some people say that this massive protest, the day after the inauguration, is disrespectful to the new administration and not giving it a chance. What do you say to those folks?
Well, tell me who Donald Trump has respected so far in the last 18 months, in the last 2 years.
Someone could say take the high road, right?
You know, this is about taking the high road, and this is about making clear that we're going to continue to fight for values and principles and policies that have made us successful here in Massachusetts, and policies that are working for families across this country. And it's time for folks to come together. I think it's wonderful that people are speaking up and speaking out. I think we're going to see more of that in the weeks and the months and the years ahead. And again, some of this reflects what I believe is absolutely justified fear, concern, uncertainty, and frankly, real disappointment and hurt as a result of things that Donald Trump has said and done. We absolutely will move on as a nation, the president-elect will be sworn in tomorrow. But that doesn't mean that we don't continue to fight for and to work for and support certain policies and certain principles and stand up for certain values. And I think that, you know, most Americans and most people in Massachusetts, they don't want to see Roe versus Wade reversed. They don't want climate change denied. They don't want people to lose access to health care. And they want to make sure that we don't roll back on some of the important reforms that were put in place to deal with Wall Street abuses. And, you know, unfortunately, Donald Trump and some of his cabinet nominees may want to go in those directions, but I think all the more important for people in Massachusetts and across this country to take the opportunity to come out and be clear about the policies and the principles they're going to fight for and support. So I look forward to seeing men and women and children and folks of all ages on Saturday. I think it'll be a great event. We're going to kick off at 11 at the Boston Common and invite everybody on down.
You know, I did read certain comments on social media about folks participating, and there are some critics, some who say that the movement itself here is divided, different viewpoints among some of the women who are either participating or are not participating. But also I heard one critic say, you know, this is predominantly a lot of liberal middle class and upper middle class white women who were not satisfied with the outcome of the election. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I think come Saturday and see what you see. I mean, I think I'm hearing from people from all walks of life, all races, ethnicities, religions, socioeconomic levels, frankly, even political parties who want to come out, bring their kids, bring their families. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And we're a democracy, and in that spirit, people are welcome to and should share views on any number of things. And to the extent there's commentary or opinion about the march, that's to be welcomed. But I think what's really important here is that there is no doubt there is a strong consensus that turning out and showing up and gathering is a good thing. I think it's a good thing for our democracy, and I think it's a wonderful act of civic engagement. And I think that's what we really see right now. A lot of people want to get involved. And, you know, the more people who get involved in their communities, the better off we're going to be. The better off we're going to be as a state, the better off we're going to be as a country. So I think we should really see this as a real positive and embrace that. And I've heard nothing and felt nothing but good vibes going into this event on Saturday.
All right. Well, let's hope it's warm as well for everyone's sake.
That would be nice.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. She'll be speaking at tomorrow's Boston Women's March for America on Boston Common. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
For another perspective on tomorrow's inauguration, we turn to former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who will be in Washington to watch as Donald Trump is inaugurated president.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to him talking about trying to unify the country and obviously addressing a lot of the economic concerns that not only I and others have, but people throughout the Midwest and the Rust Belt areas dealing with Obamacare and just kind of laying out an agenda and where he feels he can find cooperation with the minority party and where he feels he's just going to need to go with the simple majority to get things done.
So, you know, we heard from a lot of protesters who are going to be at the inauguration tomorrow. There's also plans for enormous protests around the country on Saturday, including in Washington and in Boston. So what do you say to those folks who are demonstrating at last count, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands of people because of their concerns about the Trump presidency?
Well, I think I would speak more about the amount of supporters, which I think are going to far exceed the protesters, which I think those numbers will be dwarfed in comparison of to all the folks that are actually celebrating and looking at this as not only a new president, an orderly transition of power, as our country has done for so many years. That's what separates us from every other country. It's really not about the protesters. It's not about the congressman and the president. It's about our process and our democratic process. And I think it's disrespectful to that process. While they have certainly have the ability to protest, that's fine. The election's long over. And if this was happening it's at the length that it was happening against President Obama, there would be a complete and total outrage by not only the people who were and deeply offended, but by the media as well.
You're feeling that that's, it wouldn't be covered as much if it were a different president.
If this level of protest was leveled against President Clinton or President Obama, you would just see complete and total 24/7 coverage by saying how outrageous it is and how unpatriotic it is and how un-American it is and how it's an attack on our democracy and the process of orderly transitions of power, yet you don't hear that from a lot of folks, and I find that disappointing.
Well, there may be folks, though, who would also say that it's people's constitutional right to stage protests like this, and you know, this was not a landslide victory in this election, certainly in the popular vote.
It was an electoral landslide victory, with all due respect. It's not just about the popular vote. You know as well as I do, and the folks that are protesting know as well as I do. You need to win the Electoral College. And that's, you don't just win one part of the election.
But all I'm saying is that there was obviously deep divisions, and folks are expressing those, and they may say that
divisions. There was divisions when President Obama won. He barely won as well. That's the nature of the beast. But bottom line is, we're Americans first, and our country is way more important, I think, than you know, the ability to continuously, you know, demean and attack and belittle the process and the president-elect. It's time to move on and give this president-elect a chance. Hmm.
You know, I can understand your feelings about the protesters, but there are also some lawmakers who are actually skipping the inauguration and protest. One of them, Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark, also Congressman Mike Capuano. But we have a bit of a clip here from Congresswoman Clark that I'd like you to listen to. Here it is.
I could not attend an inauguration because it would normalize this presidency when I feel that we need to sound the alarm about the threat that he presents to our democracy.
So would you say the same thing there, Scott Brown, that Congresswoman Clark is showing a disrespect for the office of the presidency by saying something like that?
It's not about her, and shame on her for not really honoring our process and our Constitution. I think it's self-serving, and she has an affirmative obligation as an elected official to go down and respect the orderly transition of power.
You know, you mentioned Obamacare when we started out. And when you ran for Senate in Massachusetts in 2009, you did run on a promise to vote against Obamacare. Are you concerned about what's happening right now in the efforts to repeal it without at least a full replacement plan in public as of yet?
No, I think there's plenty of alternatives. And to have people think that people are going to die is really abhorrent. It's inappropriate and it's not true. People can go into any emergency room, as they've done and continue to do, anytime they want, and they'll get full coverage. If there's a transition period, those folks will be grandfathered and there will be protections. You know, I'm familiar with the proposals and a lot of them are superior. And to take the wet blanket off of individuals and businesses and all the restrictions that allow for lower work weeks and have these incredibly ridiculous plans where you have high deductibles and high copays and lesser care and coverage is completely wrong.
You know, there's some confusion here in Massachusetts in particular about how this state might fare and whether it'll be different because we have already had universal health care before the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I can answer that pretty directly. As a result of Obamacare, the unions and the teachers and the police and fire, their Cadillac plans were going to be dramatically affected. Mm-hmm. And now those hard-earned benefits that they bargained for will be protected, and they should continue to get the Cadillac plans that they negotiated in good faith for. So I'm hopeful for them, and I'm thankful they'll have the opportunity to keep those plans. With regard to Commonwealth Care and all the other programs in between in Massachusetts, Obamacare has actually put a wet blanket on a lot of those. So I'm hopeful that as a result of those changes, states like Massachusetts and others that have their own plans and want to go in a different direction will get that opportunity. All the above, all the tools in the toolbox approach to have different plans for different states and different individuals. That's part of what's not there now.
So the folks who say that really the Affordable Care Act just needs tweaking, it's not perfect, but it did provide millions of Americans with health insurance. Why repeal it all? Why not just tweak?
Well, for all those people who want the so-called tweaking, with all due respect, the Democrats, when I got there, we filed over 400 amendments. They would have so-called tweaked it and fixed it, and the Democrats rejected every single one of them. So now for them to come back and say, oh, we really just want to fix it, it's disingenuous, and it really falls on deaf ears. Right now you have an opportunity to repeal it and put in place something that works. And, you know, I look forward to offering my guidance as a result of working in Massachusetts on that plan and also having a complete knowledge of what's happening in the good and bad and ugly with Obamacare.
Well, let's talk about your guidance or your potential guidance. In a Trump administration, your name was floated as a possible choice to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. Senator Warren said she would support you in that role. What were the discussions like with the Trump transition team about that?
I was number two. You know, they gave it to Dr. Shulkin, who certainly has his work cut out for him, and it was an honor to be considered. Senator Warren and I have spoken on numerous occasions privately. Not only about this, but other issues. We seem to have moved on from our election battles, as is appropriate. She cares very deeply about veterans, as I do. So I was honored to have her kind words and support. And, you know, there are other opportunities that, you know, but he hasn't even been sworn in yet. And I'm in the process. Dr. Shulkin and I have ideas. They're reaching out to see what my thoughts are on these issues. And, you know, because it's really about the veterans. It's not about us.
So do you see yourself working in the Trump administration or in Veterans Affairs in some capacity, maybe not as, head of the department?
That's really up to the new head of the VA and the president-elect. If it's something that he feels, listen, Scott, we need your help, then if the president calls, you obviously give that great consideration. So I'm just, looking forward to participating in being down in D.C. for a couple of days and then letting things settle and then figure out where we go from here.
Former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown speaking with us from his home in New Hampshire. Stay with us. Coming up, we want to hear your thoughts about the inauguration and the weekend protest marches around the country, including the one here in Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're continuing our coverage of the preparations for the big political weekend ahead with the inauguration of Donald Trump in Washington and the protests scheduled around the country, including one that's expected to bring tens of thousands of demonstrators to Boston Common Saturday. We also want to hear what you're thinking on this eve of the Trump inauguration. What do you hope from the next president, or fear, or what are you expecting from a Trump presidency? Are you going to Washington? Are you marching in Boston? Why or why not? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We just heard two perspectives on the inauguration. One from Attorney General Maura Healey, who says that this weekend, the march, especially in Boston, is going to be a call for solidarity. We also heard from former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who says the protest marches are disrespectful to the administration. Again, we'd like to hear your thoughts at 800-423-8255. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks joins us on the line from Washington. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, Deborah.
And also from Cambridge, Charles Freed is with us. He teaches at Harvard Law School, and he served as Solicitor General of the United States under President Reagan from 1985 to 1989. Professor Freed, welcome.
It's lovely to be here.
So, Anthony, let's start with you. What's the mood like in Washington right now on this eve of the inauguration?
Well, I mean, there's sort of two moods that you sense out in the street. I mean, on the one hand, I think there's a lot of excitement. You see it and feel it. The streets are the reviewing stands are already up on the streets. That's where the parade is going to go by the White House and on the way to the Capitol tomorrow after the inauguration. And there's a real sense of a historic transition taking place here. Lots of tourists in town, a lot of them Trump supporters. I talked to them yesterday. So there's a real sense of people wanting to participate in a significant historical moment. At the same time, you get a sense of uncertainty. I mean, don't forget, this is a city that voted 93% for Hillary Clinton. So it's saying goodbye to a president that is viewed very favorably here among most folks in Washington, D.C. And there's real, I would say, uncertainty and a real sense of uncertainty. And that's what you feel out in the street.
Is it very different, Anthony, would you say, from the mood 8 years ago when Obama was elected?
Oh, yeah, I think it is. I mean, again, you know, looking at the way people in the District of Columbia vote, I mean, when Barack Obama was elected president as the first African-American president in a majority African-American city, there was a huge sense of historical significance to this election. And there was a real sense of sort of jubilation and partying. You don't feel that sense of jubilation out there right now. I think I've used the word uncertainty about five times in the last minute, but that's sort of what I feel more in the street than the kind of, you know, let's get this party started when Barack Obama was elected. So that's one of the big, big differences.
And of course, the day after the inauguration, we have these huge protest marches in Washington, and the one that's expected, at least at last count, more than 60,000 people expected on Boston Common Saturday. But I want to get to Professor Freed first before we talk about that. Professor Freed, you recently wrote an op-ed in The Globe, and you titled it, "Have an Open Mind, but Hold Trump Accountable." What does that mean?
Well, first thing is all this illegitimacy and impeachment nonsense has to stop. It's ridiculous, and it makes the appropriate opposition to Trump, and there will be lots of occasions for it, seem silly and plays right into his hands. He was elected. The Electoral College elected him. He is the president.
But you know, Professor, I mean, a lot of folks are frightened about what happened with Russia. What was the influence on their election here?
There are some things happened that shouldn't have happened. Hmm. But they don't change the fact that he is the president.
Hmm. But do you keep your mouth shut?
I beg your pardon?
But do you keep your mouth shut?
Do you do what?
Keep quiet.
No, you don't keep quiet, but you don't say he isn't the president. He is the president. You've got to live with that. And as patriotic Americans, you have to make the best of it. Uh-huh. And you hear all this impeachment talk. That's rubbish. In our long history, two presidents have been impeached. Both impeachments failed. The first one was political and badly conceived. The second was a comedy and trivial. And the American people thought it was trivial. So we don't... impeachment, that's banana republic stuff.
What do you think is probably the key issue that citizens and members of Congress might be able to come together on and work with the president?
It's clear that the health care thing is the most crucial thing. Because Trump, who has said many things, many of which contradict each other, but he has been very emphatic that he is going to produce something which is better than the Affordable Care Act. It's going to be cheaper, it's going to cover more people, and it's going to provide better coverage. Those are his clear commitments. Now, how he's going to do that is a total mystery, particularly since he's got to deal with Paul Ryan, who, in my judgment, is a complete fake. His prescription is tax credits and health savings accounts, which are things which will help only people who don't need the help. Most of the people who need the help don't earn enough for tax credits to make a difference, and they certainly can't afford health savings accounds. And that's obvious.
Right.
And as I say, he's a fake.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I just wanted to say you asked where...
and therefore, Trump is in fact going to have to confront Ryan. And the two of them are going to have to, somebody's going to have to blink.
Professor, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm wondering what you think, though, about the concerns that we've heard that by sort of trying to work within the system, you're almost normalizing some things that really are way out of place for a U.S. presidency.
Well, what are the alternatives? What does it mean to work outside the system? That is a Trump-like cliche or slogan. I mean, the system is what we have. It's our government. It's the United States. That's what we do.
I just mean about drawing the line as to what is normal and what isn't. And then
you draw all the lines you want. What is the significance of having drawn that line?
Anthony, let's talk a little bit about the protest in Washington this weekend. What are you hearing about that?
You know, I'd love to get to the protest, but I just want to add one thing to what you had been talking about with the professor, and that is in terms of where the opposition, the Democrats, the minority, can work with the Republicans. I mean, the thing that I've heard again and again and again, I heard it from Senator Markey just a few minutes ago, I heard it from other members of our congressional delegation over the last couple of days, and that is infrastructure spending. The Democrats have been wanting to push this for a long, long time. They were unsuccessful under President Obama. President-elect Trump has indicated that he wants to spend big on infrastructure. So the Democrats are basically saying, okay, let's talk about how to do that. Now, if what Trump means by infrastructure spending are big tax credits for, the construction industry, maybe they're not going to find much common ground with the Democrats. But if he's serious about a bill that's going to, commit some public resources to a big infrastructure bill, I think that's some place where Democrats and Republicans can come together. And it's what you hear both of them talking about.
And let's hope we have a good bit of each.
I want to make sure we get some callers in as well. We want to remind folks that we are asking you your thoughts on the inauguration tomorrow and the protests this weekend. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Angelina is calling from Arlington. Angelina, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment, and I will be joining the protest tomorrow in Boston. I was going to try to make my way out to Washington, but I will stand here. I will be, local, and I'm terrified. I'm going to stand with these people protesting because I don't believe in Trump's very vague plans in what he has for this country. And it's only Trump supporters who believe he has one and, stand for what he doesn't clearly state. And it's not only going to be Boston, not only Washington, not only this country. There will be protests worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this just doesn't happen, this is just not normal.
Okay, Angelina, you are taking to the streets to show your dissatisfaction with the fact that Donald Trump is president. I want to hear from more listeners before we run out of time. Patrick is calling from Arlington. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my comment. I'm originally from Ireland, naturalized mm-hmm. citizen, came here 28 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I embody the American dream, and I'm absolutely appalled that so many Americans don't even know their history, but that they would sell out, they would sell their values, their principles, and our ideals. It's what makes us great. And the fact that we have put, in my mind, Mr. Trump represents what is wrong with the country. And I will be protesting, but I am just appalled at the fact that so many of my fellow citizens would sell themselves short and put all their hopes in a man who clearly stands for nothing.
Or everything.
I'm sorry. I grew up in Belfast, Northern Ireland under Margaret Thatcher's regime. And believe me, I come from the streets. And I spent 20 years as a college professor teaching American history, and I know the difference between right and wrong. And time, well, I guess the American people are going to have to find out the hard way that this man is not the real deal.
But what do you think of Professor Fried saying, we have to accept, and we have to really hope that he succeeds as the country's president? He's elected.
In all respect to Professor Fried, and the only time I ever gave money to a politician was Barack Obama, and I gave just under $1,000 because I believed in what he had to say. Now, did he make good on everything he promised? No, but it was important to send a message to the world, especially after 8 years of George Bush, that, look, this is America, e pluribus unum.
I'm with you there.
On many.
Okay, yes. Professor, go ahead.
I voted for Barack Obama also, both times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Deborah, I think what I would say to your caller, I mean, I think I take his point. I hear his passion. It's moving to hear someone call in who grew up in the streets of Belfast, and I get that and I appreciate it. But I think it's important. I mean, reasonable people can disagree on whether or not Donald Trump has made promises that make sense. But I think as, what I try to do as a journalist, and I think what we ought to be sort of focusing on here, is many millions of Americans did support the man. And it's worth asking why. It's worth asking what policies were in place that drove a million voters in deep blue Massachusetts to vote for Donald Trump. That's really the question that interests me. So in a way to dismiss Donald Trump just a joke and someone who should be, not taken seriously, in a way is to dismiss the many millions of voters who really felt a stirring need for change in this country.
Right.
So that's the only response.
And we've spoken, with several of those voters who have said just that. It was the idea of change. But I want to just make sure we get another perspective in here. Dean is calling from Hyde Park. Dean is on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to say that I am really sick of Republicans and conservatives criticizing citizens who are protesting the inauguration or elected officials who are boycotting the inauguration. This is a party who openly made it their top priority to make Obama a one-term president, and they bragged about it. So they have zero moral authority to criticize.
Okay. Dean, thanks very much for your call. I wonder what you say to folks like Dean. I'm going back to you, Professor. Who...
Oh, I think that Mitch McConnell used to be a decent and important man when he was first elected. His statement about making Barack Obama a one-term president was totally unpatriotic and disgraceful. He disgraced himself and he disgraced his party. So I agree with your last speaker. I mean, the idea is we don't care if America fails so long as Obama fails. And that's practically treasonous.
I want to take another call here. Lynn is calling from Dorchester. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I appreciate the protesters who feel compelled to protest, but, I think it's important to remember that we have a peaceful transition of power, and whether we like it or not, this is the way the cards were dealt, and it seems counterproductive, exactly as your guest said, to hope that the person fails simply because they don't like the person who has been elected.
And do you support Donald Trump?
I did not support Hillary Clinton, and I think, I think we needed a change in how we look at our country. And I think Trump offered that, and that's my understanding of why the election turned the way it is. I also think the media, made this complete dichotomy between Clinton and Trump, and that people who are appalled and just, so disturbed by the election, really bought into the dichotomy that was presented, and that's disturbing in and of itself.
Okay, Anthony, I want to go to you now. I mean, this theme of change, of course, was what many folks did say won the election here. Are there thoughts from particularly members of our delegation about what that might mean in Massachusetts?
You mean
how change is going to play itself out and how we take those million voters you talked about earlier in this blue state of Massachusetts and incorporate them into what's happening here, particularly because we have an all-Democratic delegation?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're hearing from the delegation, I mean, as you know, two members of the delegation aren't going to be attending the inauguration at all. And I think what you're hearing from the others is an effort to look for some middle ground where they can work with Donald Trump. But I think what, they're waiting to hear is what is Donald Trump going to say tomorrow in his inaugural speech? Because throughout the transition, there's a real sense that, he has continued to sort of offer this pretty tough rhetoric, these Twitter wars and so on and so forth, that have actually driven his approval numbers down, according to polls. So they're looking for some signal, I think, is there going to be a president who is going to reach out and offer some kind of olive branch and some kind of sincere effort to bring the whole country together?
If I jump into there, it's very interesting that a large number of Trump's national security people, the Secretary of State designate, the UN delegate, Nikki Haley.
Just a few seconds, Professor.
All of these people have violently disagreed with Trump on Russia, and he has pulled back. And they are not going to change. So it's they are very good people. Papeo and Mathis and I think Tillotson and certainly Nikki Haley.
Well, certainly it is going to be very interesting. Charles Fried, he teaches at Harvard Law School, served as Solicitor General of the U.S. under President Reagan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who joined us from Washington. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
This song, Chattanooga Choo Choo, by Glenn Miller and the Modernaires, is considered a prime example of how the sounds of trains influenced jazz music. Conductor, composer, and author Rob Capello is looking at why trains were such a key part of jazz and how musicians incorporated those sounds into their songs. Capello will be speaking about some of this history, and he'll be performing at the New England Conservatory tomorrow as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. And he joins us in studio to give us a preview. Welcome.
So glad to be here.
So why are trains so important to jazz?
Well, you know, at first I had absolutely no idea what the answer to that question was. And not only did I have no answer, I had never actually thought about it. You know, but then I came across this incredible book. You know, normally my programs begin with music that I'm interested in, but this one began with a book or an idea. And this book was called Railroads and the African American Experience, written in 2010. And I thought, wow, this seems like an interesting topic. And all of a sudden, I started to realize the enormous influence of railroads on the African American experience. I mean, they literally built the railroads in the pre-Civil War South. I mean, almost all of the employment in the South came through these railroads. And then there's a great line in this book where he talks about how it had massive influence on travel, culture, employment, and also music as well. And all these work songs and spirituals were about trains. And not only that, the train kind of became a metaphor for either going to heaven. Half of the songs, you were going to heaven in the blues songs. Half of them, you were going to hell. And of course, we all know Take the A Train. Right. And the more I started to realize that these trains were part of everything, I started to see there were hundreds of jazz songs. And the more you read about their lives, you realized also those trains literally made the lives of these big swing bands popular, because they would go from town to town by the railroad trains, and most of these musicians would spend most of their lives on the trains having these sounds in their heads. And in the case of Duke Ellington's band, I mean, the only way you could travel safely in the South, since all the housing was segregated, was to have your own train. So literally, when they would go through the South, they would live on the trains, and what's in your consciousness actually becomes part of your music.
Well, let's just go back a little bit to the song we started with.
Can you still remember that song?
Before we get to Duke Ellington.
You got me started. The book is 500 pages. Don't get me started.
Let's talk about Chattanooga Choo Choo. Walk me through the music a little bit here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So this issue of how do you turn the train sounds into music, what do I call train onomatopoeia, so to speak. So now, I mean, he starts off with a simple idea. I mean, this doesn't sound much like a train. Not so much.
No.
Now, normally, if you were going to put some chords under it, you'd put some nice simple major chords like this. I mean, that would sound fine. But to make it sound like a train, he has every instrument do it starting on a different note. Here, 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 in this wonderful whole tone kind of sound. So instead of this, he does this. And it starts to sound a little bit like a train. And then the next thing, what does a train do next? Well, it leaves the station and it accelerates. So instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, it goes double speed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Then it goes quadruple speed, which is hard to say. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Same time, you've got swooping trombones. Wow, wow, I'm going choo, choo in a highly dissonant way. And then you have trumpets, who normally would play this. But to turn it into jazz and to turn it into a train, you do dissonance. And suddenly the sound of the trains is literally actually becoming jazz music. And if you put it together and you rehear that opening now, you'll hear that slow train, whole tone sound, getting faster and faster, swooping trombones being the train whistle, and then the jazz. Let's just hear that one little segment one more time. Here it is. Double time. Trombone, quadruple time, choo, choo, trumpets, now down a scale, now clarity, and we're at our tune.
Right, and the lyrics. Now tell us a little bit. Okay, so now we've got the lyrics on top of all this to make it perfectly clear.
Absolutely.
In case there was any confusion. So describe that a little
bit. And, you know, the lyrics immediately give you a feeling of what civil rights situation was at the time. I mean, it's amazing how lyrics embed American history within them. You know, pardon me, boy, Is that the Chattanooga choo-choo? Then they go, yes, yes, track 29. Boy, you can give me a shine. I mean, in just those few lines, you get the whole situation of the South in the 1940s with luxury train travel in which white passengers are served by black Pullman porters and black shoeshine boys, which was almost the only regular employment that you could get at the time. And in just those few lines, you get the world of Plessy versus Ferguson, of separate but equal, mm-hmm. of segregated luxury train travel. And, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson was actually a case about a black person who refused to get off a white train.
So there's an awful lot going on there. But you also mentioned Duke Ellington as an example of how things are done a little bit differently. Explain that a little bit.
Well, you know, as I say, Duke Ellington probably wrote more famous train pieces than anyone. And I really do think it's because he had his own train and he absolutely lived on that train. But in Ellington's case, he takes the language of Glenn Miller and makes it even more dissonant and more abstract. And in one of his most famous pieces that we'll be playing with the fantastic Kyle, a Thade big band, by the way, one of this fantastic New York big bands. He starts off with this incredibly dissonant, abstract train chord for the piano, like this. And he plays it six times syncopated. Over and over again. I mean, it's a beautiful beginning. At the same time, in between, there's this bizarre double bass going... I mean, this is one of the weirdest ways to begin a piece. I mean, you know, normally you think of a piece beginning with like a nice stable frame with a chord, like it can go home to your mother, something like this. But no, it begins with this incredibly dissonant, abstract twain whistle. And then it gets even worse. He has this great version. How do you make a chugging train? Now, you got to imagine him every night traveling on one of these night trains. And he takes something that, if it were Glenn Miller, might sound nice like this. But he does this wonderful dissonant version. He changes two notes in this chord. This is Glenn Miller, but he first changes it to this. But then he adds one dissonant note that makes it Duke Ellington. And now suddenly it's a steam train. Then the third chord, instead of being this, he changes to this. So this nice little Glenn Miller pattern comes this wonderful Duke Ellington pattern. And suddenly you've got this chugging pattern. Now, what's so amazing, it repeats over and over again 52 measures of the same thing. So you got to imagine this chugging train. On top, he puts these abstract, dissonant steam train sounds. And you get this wonderful combination of a night train ride interrupted by shrieks and train whistle blasts. Let's listen to a little bit of the beginning of this. And you'll hear layer after layer. You'll hear a simple trumpet going... but with some quick little grace notes that feel like blues. Not this, but over and over, low moaning trains. All on top of this repeated pattern, what we call an ostinato. Let's hear a little of that. Listen to that weird double bass.
Yeah.
Here we go. Night train ride, chugging train, trumpets. Low train whistles. This is an abstract train ride. The wailing saxophone on type. Train whistle plus blues.
I just love hearing you explain this.
Oh, it's amazing music.
It really is.
You got to come on tomorrow night. You'll get all 90 minutes of it.
It is incredible. I mean, I'm learning so much here. I'm wondering if we could go out on something fun, and you could tell us a little bit about this song from Count Basie.
Yeah, Count Basie. This is a great one because you've been hearing all these dissonant sounds. We should have something fun to listen to. Count Basie wrote one of the famous train songs called The Super Chief, which is actually the flagship train of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway. And here, unlike one of these slow ones, it's a fast express train streaking to Los Angeles, California. Listen to the train whistle, half-valve trumpets.
Very nice. very nice. That's Count Basie's super chief.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay, Rob Capello, composer, conductor, and author. It's really been great fun. Thanks so much for this fascinating history about jazz and trains. Listeners, if you want to hear Rob's more expansive look at how trains influence jazz, he'll be speaking and performing at the New England Conservatory tomorrow night as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. There's more information on our website, radioboston.org. Thanks very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.